are listening to Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 FM and kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Tis the season to consume. That's, of course, this country's approach to the holidays. Most people make their biggest purchases of the year between Thanksgiving and New Year's Day. Computers, electronics, furniture, cars. However, we may be getting more than we bargained for, including exposure to toxic chemicals, one group of which has been declared the next PCBs. But first, I want to welcome Sonia Lunder, analyst with the Environmental Working Group, which has done research on chemicals and consumer products. Welcome to you, Sonia.
Thank you.
Many people tend to think of toxic dangers as coming from our external environment, pollution from cars and factories and incinerators and the like. Should our internal environment, what we have and use within our own homes, should that concern us as well?
Yeah, there's increasing evidence that the products that we surround ourselves with and that we buy intentionally, in some cases to make ourselves feel safer, are actually filled with a lot of different types of persistent chemicals that may be affecting our health.
Wow, that's so. Tell us in broad terms where we might find toxic chemicals embedded, incorporated into products we use every day.
Well, our recent work has focused on a persistent class of toxic fire retardants, and the product list is kind of baffling. We start with the products that are fire retardants in infant mattresses. Think about your couches and easy chairs, the padding underneath your carpet, but also a whole host of electronic products ranging from coffee makers to electronic computers and computer parts. The list can be kind of daunting.
Well, let's begin the list then. Something called PBDEs. I'm going to try the name of this, polybrominated diphenyl ethers. And you folks have done a lot of research on these as they exist in fire retardants, flame retardants. What are these retardants? Let's start with, what are these PBDEs?
Well, these are bromine-containing chemicals that are intentionally put into plastics and foam to protect them from fire ignition. And so, as I mentioned, these are products that are used in bedding and in home furnishings, as well as electronic products. They're intentional, and they're put in dozens of products that we have daily contact with. So that's the basis for our concern when we find out later that they have toxic effects on laboratory animals at quite low levels, and that concentrations in people's bodies and in wildlife have been increasing dramatically over the past decade.
Wow. Well, first of all, how are these PBDEs incorporated into the manufacturing process, say into a mattress or a couch or something like that?
Well, that's actually an interesting question. These are chemicals that are mixed into plastic or foam when they're made. However, they're not bound in, and so we find that they actually can migrate out at a slow rate. But it's when your foam products are breaking down or when they're in a landfill, they're getting out and they're getting into funny products like food or infant bodies or seagulls.
Oh, wow. Okay, so what do the laboratory tests show as far as the impact of PBDEs in, as you said, higher and higher concentrations on, I don't know, what, lab animals and humans even?
Yeah, well, two pieces of information that concern us. One is that there are increasing concentrations in people's bodies. The tests that we did measured the concentration in women's breast milk, and we use that as an indicator of what's in a mom's body while she's pregnant. The concern, looking at the laboratory studies, is that the developing animal during pregnancy is the most sensitive to the toxic effects, and those include sensitive impacts like learning and memory and behavior that are observable at quite low concentrations when given to laboratory animals. So then we focus on the pregnant woman as the sentinel population. If she is, if the concentration in her is too high, then that is affecting all generations to come.
And so what happens to learning and memory and cognition in lab animals as they use this stuff? What do we know about that?
Well, we find more erratic behavior. It's hard to give an intelligence test to a laboratory animal, but the sensitive studies really find there are permanent effects on learning, memory, and behavior as you can measure them in animals, and they appear to worsen with age. Unfortunately, Or fortunately, we don't have studies that look at human exposure, partially because a human baby is exposed to many different types of persistent chemicals in utero that would all impact similar targets in the body. And that also that with the epidemic of learning and behavior disorders, attributing that or the share of that phenomenon to any one chemical would be extremely difficult and would require quite extreme exposure scenarios. I think we're lucky that we haven't been able to trace each one chemical to a specific problem in children, but at the same time, it's hard for us to know where to start in terms of protecting kids' health.
Now, we're joined in studio by Sonia Lunder. She's an environmental analyst with the Environmental Working Group, an analyst with a background in public health, and EWG is a founding member of the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics. We'll get into health care and beauty products in a moment. If at least there's some questions about the health impacts of PBDEs in fire retardants and flame retardants, then I would think that safety tests would be done on these chemicals, on these products containing these chemicals before they went out onto the market. Is that being done?
Well, you're hitting the nail right on the head. We're finding that there are 85,000 industrial chemicals that are used in high volume in the United States, and very few of those have even the basic safety profile testing before they're put into widespread use. Only after we put pounds of PBDEs into consumer products that we have intimate exposure with did we stop and look, and it was actually the part of advocacy groups and some scientists in universities that recognized that these were accumulating in high concentrations in people and wildlife. Only after these products literally our home do we take a step back and say, wow, are these going to persist in the environment? What would their health effects be? And I think that is the thread that integrates our diverse work on the Teflon family of chemicals or on a lot of cosmetic chemicals. The fact that we're finding that human exposure is so varied and so extreme, and then we're looking back and saying, wow, we have really incomplete information about how this might be affecting our health, let alone how the combination of each of those types of exposures work on a baby who's going through a crucial stage of brain development inside their mother.
Well, if we can't count on, let's say, industry scientists to do that safety testing beforehand, then I look to the government, to federal regulators, to state regulators, to put some standards or to require some testing of these chemicals and products beforehand. What's the state of regulation?
Well, these are all governed under a federal regulation called TSCA, and the stakes are very skewed against the regulators at this point. They have 2 weeks to review a pre-manufacturing notice by an industry group that plans to use a new chemical, and they can ask for certain types of new information, but I think they're just overwhelmed with such a backlog of new submissions. Also, any product that was in use before the passing of this law in the late 1970s was grandfathered in, and we've never taken a step to look back and find out even the basic safety profile and environmental profile of these chemicals, and we're finding with the fire retardants and Teflon chemicals that those can proven to be highly important. Then with the cosmetics that you mentioned, they fall under the jurisdiction of the FDA, and actually by their own admission, the FDA cannot require companies to do any safety testing of their cosmetics products before marketing. So you'll find that regulation is minimal under the EPA and non-existent under the FDA.
So you said, and let's just jump to this point, you said 2 weeks between the time that a federal agency gets notice that this thing will be in this manufactured product, they have 2 weeks to figure out whether it's dangerous and to notify the manufacturer so that the product isn't made?
Yeah, or even to say we need a basic toxicity test to be done. We want to know how this product is going to behave in the environment. So with the fire retardants that we were talking about earlier, the two most toxic and concerning forms are going to be phased out at the end of this year. However, we have substantial concerns that there's inadequate look at the chemicals that we're going to use to replace them. And actually, a kind of review by the British government of 344 chemical fire retardants found that there was no toxicity data for 80% and no information about the persistence for 90% of these chemicals. So we know that fire retardants will be put into the mattresses and foam furniture after January of 2005, but we don't know which, and we have concerns that we may be substituting an equally problematic chemical for the one that we've worked so hard to ban.
Right. There are three types, at least in your reports, penta, octa, and deca, right? And it's the penta and octa that certain bands apply to, including in California, is that correct?
Yeah, California passed regulation to ban the type of fire retardants that are used in foam, and the type that has not yet been regulated and is used in high volumes as well is put into electronic products. And there have been different types of commitments by the manufacturers to reevaluate their use of these chemicals, and different companies, Apple, Dell, Ericsson, Intel, Philips, Xerox, have set goals of phasing out DECA PBDE. We're not sure exactly the timeline, and like I mentioned with the replacements, we also want to know that the replacements that they're going to use are the least toxic and the least likely to persist in the environment.
How about for products that already have these PBDEs in them, labeling requirements?
The California legislation had tried to enact labeling requirements, and that was vigorously fought by the industry. And that harkens back to the problem with the electronic users as well. They don't necessarily want to put labels on products. This brand of cell phone by Motorola might not contain brominated fire retardants, but by labeling it, they kind of cast a doubt onto their other products. And we find that that's a real barrier to complete information. I think a parent who's shopping for an infant mattress might want to know exactly what is known about the fire retardants that the industry is putting in. One thing we haven't talked about here are the non-chemical solutions to meet some of these design challenges. Are there ways that we can design products up front to make them far less resistant, more resistant to ignition? One thing that we've focused on is redefining or reformulating cigarettes so that they don't smolder for 45 minutes. That would be a really safe and effective way of alleviating a lot of fire risk in mattresses or easy chairs, and that would actually get all of those questionable chemicals out of new products. We also haven't talked about the fact that the products that are already made and already in our homes are going to be there for a while. When you think about your furniture or electronics, those are things that you don't just throw out and get new ones every year. At least I hope not.
If PBDEs are accumulating or are being shown to be in increasing levels in the breast milk of women in this country, should women not breastfeed their children?
I'm really glad you asked that question. Absolutely not. We feel that breastfeeding is one of the most important things a mom can do to protect her child's health from communicable diseases. But also, if you're concerned about chemicals, you need to know that the components of breast milk that are absent from infant formula are actually the ones that protect their neurodevelopment, their brain, and affect learning, memory, and behavior. And that might be one of the most protective things you can do as a mom, is to breastfeed for as long as possible. We are learning so much about the really important components of breast milk. And also concerns about not only things that are absent in infant formula, but moms reconstitute mixing up that infant formula with water that contains contaminants or that hasn't been regulated to make sure that those levels may be safe for an average adult, but are they safe for a bottle-fed infant? So there are just lots of reasons to breastfeed, and unfortunately it can be a little bit of a confusing message when moms hear about contaminants in breast milk, but I'd like to underscore that we're using that as a marker of what's in her body while she's pregnant, and that is the crucial period of development for the baby. They're much more resilient once they're born, and obviously we want to protect the nursing infant by protecting their mom's bodies prior to pregnancy, throughout pregnancy, and after pregnancy from these chemicals.
Sure. Sonia Lunder with the Environmental Working Group. She works at the Oakland-based office. There is the headquarters in Washington, D.C. The Environmental Working Group analyzes government data and scientific studies and conducts its own laboratory tests to expose threats to public health and the environment. And I think we've sort of touched on this, but from what you've been saying about sort of older mattresses and furniture, one way PBDEs get into our bodies must be through somehow ingesting them. Are there other ways in which it can be incorporated into our body?
Yeah, well, we've actually studied the concentration of these fire retardants in household dust. And unlike PCBs or mercury and those chemicals that are coming to us in our diet, there's actually ample evidence that these products are coming to us directly by the breakdown of consumer products in our own homes. And an interesting comparison that we've come to only after a year or two of study is that we measure the concentration of these fire retardants in fish caught in the San Francisco Bay and in the bodies of women nursing mothers throughout the United States. And actually, we find that they're within the same range. We think of the bay as an industrial place and fish living in this, you know, contaminated water, but we actually find that the concentration in women's bodies rivals that of fish from the San Francisco Bay. As a reminder that these consumer products are very, we have intimate exposure to them. Lots of studies of household dust find a myriad of contaminants, including pesticides. We find DDT that hasn't broken down. It's still in its original chemical format, even though the pesticide hasn't been used for about 20 years. And so that these are also very persistent chemicals in our homes.
Before we move on to Teflon and to health and beauty products, so if it's not labeled whether these PBDs are in our products, if the big companies seem to be using it, the ban doesn't apply to one of the three large categories of brominated flame retardants, then what can people do other than say, well, gee, it's just inevitable, it's going to be all over my furniture and bedding and electronics, there's nothing I can do?
Yeah, it's hard for the consumer who's going to the good guys to decide, and especially when these products aren't labeled and the manufacturers themselves are not bragging about any progress they've made to take these fire retardants out of their products. It is a difficult consumer-oriented solution. What we're looking to are some really innovative laws in the European Union that are actually restricting the use of hazardous chemicals in electronic products. And we think that only by systemic regulation to keep in the European Union, it's including lead, mercury, cadmium, chromium, and two types of fire retardants out of the products from their outset, that we're going to get them out of our homes and waste stream. Another successful tact is to pressure those manufacturers who are making those safer products for Europe to sell them also in the United States. We think that that will force the EU regulation is going to force a lot of innovation and real getting those companies out of their status quo operation, and that once they've done the work to reformulate their products, whether it be cosmetics or electronics, that they need to offer that to U.S. consumers. And so there's some consumer-led campaigns that really focus on that.
Cosmetics, health and beauty products, a lot of men use these as well. Now, this would be disturbing, right, because we apply this stuff to our face, our skin, we ingest some of it. Are you saying that some of it is dangerous to our health?
Yeah, I mean, taking a look at consumer products, a lot of these things that we put in, the chemicals we're kind of encouraged to use, either to keep our skin looking young, to keep our couch from going up in flames, or to keep our food from sticking to our Teflon pans, they're intentionally put in there to serve one purpose, but we're actually finding with cosmetics as well as these other categories I mentioned that there's very little regulation, and there are significant concerns that some of these chemicals, especially in combination, could be affecting our health.
Okay, so such as what? Let's take lipstick, nail polish, hair dye. What do we have to worry about specifically?
Yeah, there are certain ingredients that we've keyed into. What my organization did was query the existing safety information for 10,000 ingredients that are used in personal care products.
And represent
about a quarter of all the products on the market that we've kind of created the safety assessment for. We could look at specific chemicals. There's a type called phthalates, which are used in those products you just mentioned, nail care and lipstick, and in a variety of products, and they're actually banned by the European Union under some new regulation. And again, as I mentioned, we're now the advocacy effort has focused on making sure that the manufacturers who are selling safer products in Europe also offer those products on the U.S. market. And there's a very targeted campaign against Revlon, L'Oreal, and Unilever to require that and to really highlight the fact that they're making a deliberate choice not to offer safer products to the States, and that's shameful.
So even though certain of their products might be banned in the EU, and so they're reformulating their products, they're still keeping the old formula to sell to U.S. consumers?
Yes. The European regulation bans two types of phthalates, which are potent reproductive hazards. They affect the male reproductive system. Although they're found in almost everybody, the highest concentrations are in younger women, and the suspected source of that would be personal care products, which are not the only source of phthalates, but would be the most concern for young reproductive age women. The European regulation also bans carcinogens, mutagens, and reproductive toxins for use in cosmetics. So when you look at that list, I think the common sense thinking on the part of the American consumer would be, sign me up, I'd like some of that. So we've had 50 companies who've taken a pledge to offer those products to their U.S. consumers. But unfortunately, the really large industry leaders haven't seemed to respond yet.
Can you tell us any more about the suspected or the proven health impacts of phthalates?
Yeah, well, they're, as I mentioned, potent reproductive toxins and affecting male reproductive development. And the evidence appears to be quite strong, teamed with the fact that they're in measurable levels in almost everybody in the States through a variety of sources, definitely past the regulatory bar. In Europe, they took a very close look at them, and the U.S. cosmetics manufacturers have vigorously opposed any kind of restriction on phthalate use.
Right, and if it's accumulating more in women because they use more cosmetics, then some cynical folks might say, well, look, it's accumulating in women, but it seems to have more of a negative impact on men.
Oh, well, actually, to the contrary, that would be women during pregnancy. The sexual development of their male babies is being impaired in utero. So, yes, again, this is an impact that we feel most important to protect the developing infant. Of course, consumer exposure, you know, men in their 50s are still important to us. But yeah, we're focusing most of our concern on that.
Logically enough. The question of safety testing, and I'm kind of dreading what you're going to say here, but what proportion of cosmetics have actually undergone safety testing before being put out on the market?
Well, our analysis found that 89% of the ingredients that we queried off of product labels were untested. We know that over their 67-year history, the Food and Drug Administration has only banned or restricted the use of 9 ingredients, and there's a voluntary industry group that really does a lot of the screening in absence of FDA regulation, and they've also banned or restricted 9 ingredients, and they happen to be different ones. So we look at about 18 products that have been taken off the market. We
also, how many again?
We looked at 10,500 ingredients.
Okay.
Some of the ones that don't have safety and testing may be essential oils or somewhat natural products. They vary. And we urge consumers, when they read the label, if you see a lot of products, when you're looking at our analysis and trying to choose safer products, you may see some more natural ingredients aside that you're willing to take the risk with, you know, products that sound like foods you might eat. But there are lots of, you know, synthetic chemicals also, and they haven't undergone the review that we think they ought.
You're listening to Sonia Lunder. She joins us in studio on Against the Grain on KPFA. My name is C.S. Song. She's an environmental analyst with the Environmental Working Group, has done a number of studies on toxic chemicals in relation to consumer products. We'll take a short music break. And you are listening to Against the Grain on KPFA 94.1 FM, KFCF in Fresno and California's Central Valley, and worldwide on the web at kpfa.org. Co-producer Sasha Lilly is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song, and we have links on our website, againstthegrain.org, to all kinds of good information. Links to the Environmental Working Group's website. Sonia Lunder, our guest in studio, works with EWG, also to Greenpeace, and we'll hear more from a forest campaigner for Greenpeace Canada in a moment, also to the Campaign for Safe Cosmetics, which the Environmental Working Group is a founding member. What is that campaign, Sonia?
That is a campaign made up of a group of women's health and environmental activists who have focused their attention on the issue of toxic ingredients in chemical cosmetics. And as I mentioned before, one of their political goals at the moment is to pressure those cosmetic manufacturers to offer their safer products that they're selling in Europe under that they're required to by law, to offer those voluntarily to U.S. consumers. And that's the major effort on the part of the cosmetics campaign right now.
If you go to the Environmental Working Group website, ewg.org, or again, you could just go to againstthegrain.org, you will find this great, it's sort of this interactive thing where you can put in certain health and beauty products and you can find out which are the least and most toxic. That must have taken a lot of work.
Yeah, luckily it was work done in our Washington, D.C. office. But it's a great feature, a way of making our extensive database on these 10,000 ingredients available to consumers. And what you can do is you can select the products that you use daily with a shopping cart feature and get an overall summary score based on our safety assessment of the ingredients that might be of concern. You can suggest less hazardous or potentially less hazardous replacements. There are some types of products like hair dyes or nail care products that are universally concerning, and there, you know, if you don't see a safer alternative on the website or on your supermarket store shelves, might just need to consider using less or thinking about your use of that.
And that's, again, in the cosmetics section of the Environmental Working Group's website. So, on the subject of federal or state regulation of these products and how safe they are and how much testing has to be done to them before they go out in the market, can you speculate at all on the question of how much of this really lack of regulation, which you've outlined for us, is because it's just simply infeasible that there are too many demands on an agency maybe which is understaffed, and you know there are just thousands of chemicals out there and they're besieged with requests and this kind of thing, and how much of it is because industry groups, they lobby, they do various evaluations. Like you were saying before, there was sort of an industrial working group that had banned or restricted 9 additional chemicals in addition to the 9 chemicals that EPA had. How much it might be industry influence?
Well, we have a convergence of factors. We have the fact that new analytical techniques are allowing us to measure and document industrial pollution inside people's bodies, which is a real first-ever look. We have advocacy groups and activist scientists within government agencies or within universities who are really pushing the envelope and saying, you know, these things haven't been looked for. We think that they're important, and we need to start thinking about that. So the message really that these pollutants are measurable levels in infant umbilical cord blood, in the elderly, in newborn children, has really prompted the issue like none other. And I'm afraid we only find what we look for, and there's just such a small amount of testing being done that there may be things we're completely missing. You have that in tandem with, you know, real explosion of new technologies that were being marketed, you know, nonstick pans and regulations that increase fire retardancy standards, which require a use of new chemicals that are difficult to engineer. We have 85,000 industrial chemicals that are in widespread use. So we do have this challenge of rapidly screening the health effects or the environmental profile of these chemicals. And then we have government agencies who really have their hands tied with only 2 weeks to review safety notices. They're going to focus on the worst actors. And kind of casually in conversation, people who work in those groups have told me, you should see the good things we do, you know, are the things that we can avert. We don't get publicized. Those are invisible successes, which is a little worrisome to me, considering that we've had a lot of high-profile failures when we look at just the scientific literature in the last 5 years is really littered with kind of oops, we found this in polar bears type articles, which really which ought to be raising widespread concern about the things that I mentioned we aren't looking for, that we haven't got around to testing yet. Definitely we know that industry plays a role. They were really active with the fire retardants legislation and opposing labeling. They believe that we need to have a body count, proof that these things are harming children's intelligence before we take action. And considering the difficulty of determining and sorting out those particular chemicals that might be affecting a child's IQ and some of their social behavior, we feel like we need to take action far before we get to that level. And it really has been only when we have real epidemics of poisoning or when we have really signature problems, asbestos linking to bizarre types of cancer or DES, a drug given to women in pregnancy that links to really rare types of cancer in their daughters. Those have really helped scientists hone in on tracing an effect of a chemical to a human outcome. When you're talking about things that interrupt children's neurodevelopment and learning and memory, unfortunately, as I mentioned, we just don't have the power to trace out the contribution of these multiple chemicals.
Sure, that works in industry's favor. You've mentioned nonstick pans a number of times this hour. Brings to mind Teflon, which I understand is not just in nonstick pots and pans, but in Stainmaster carpets and clothing. Toxic? I mean, this is stuff we cook our food on.
Yeah, the miracle cure. I mean, think about Ronald Reagan being called the Teflon president. Unfortunately, we find that these are highly toxic and extraordinarily persistent compounds. And as you mentioned, they're used in a lot of things that you think about marketed as Teflon containing. But there's also concerns about the stain treatment on furniture and on carpeting. Think about clothes. But cosmetics and household cleaners, as well as, this is a bizarre one, get ready, the waxy paper that you might be found when you have your candy bar, the thing that the candy bar is sitting on, or the inside of the bag of the microwave popcorn, or the popcorn container you get at the movie.
Has Teflon?
Yeah, well, it has a Teflon family of chemicals. So definitely these things can be difficult to avoid, but they're non-essential in almost every use. And this is a time where when the consumer thinking about their holiday purchase could really make decisions that influence this market, avoiding buying nonstick cookware, avoiding the stain treatment on fabrics for their furniture, or definitely those Teflon or Gore-Tex, the clothing. Whether or not those are those clothing or the candy bar wrappers are the source of the Teflon that we're measuring in everybody's bodies is hard to tell, but we really need to just avoid this whole family of compounds in our products.
What's been established about what the Teflon family of products do to the human body?
We're finding that they're highly toxic, and there are a lot of different health effects on infants. They're linked to birth defects. We've found that workers in these factories making the chemicals, women have had high rates of birth defects in their children. We also found more subtle disruption to the thyroid and the brain during development, smaller growth, so the babies are being born smaller, and effects on the immune system. And adults, we find that, you know, again, there are effects in the older population. There's alteration of reproductive hormones. Find that people who are working, men who are working in these factories for years, have higher rates of prostate cancer. And in laboratory animals, we find lots of many different birth defects, including the male reproductive system.
If some of this relates to an investigation being done of DuPont Corporation, a Teflon manufacturer, a major manufacturer, then what's being done with that investigation, which I understand is still underway?
Well, Teflon is, DuPont is really under the microscope now several times, and this comes back to the TSCA regulation. They find that you need to submit some information to EPA when you want to use a new product, but also if you find that there's a problem, a toxicological problem with a chemical that you're using, you're required to let EPA know. And there are several important instances where problems were being detected in workers, including these rare birth defects, and DuPont just didn't inform EPA about it. So they're under investigation for withholding scientific information about the harm caused by their chemical.
Sonia Lunder, she is an environmental analyst with the Environmental Working Group with offices in Washington, D.C. and Oakland, California. We have a link to Environmental Working Group on our website, againstthegrain.org. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Very much appreciate it.